Unseen Diversity, Lecture 5, The Family Tree of Bacteria, Part 1.
In this lecture, I will address some things that I have mentioned before, but in the context of our understanding of the family tree of organisms, most of which is bacteria. Want to remind you that morphology can't get us far with understanding this. Bacteria are essentially featureless, especially by our standards. Remember, we're enormous morphological organisms that value other morphologies and which are highly visual and which can see color and which are our best at seeing things of about our own size and about our own activity level and with features similar to ours. So we really are in a different place when we're thinking about bacteria, and it can be something of a mistake to say, okay, what do they look like? I can tell you what they look like. They look like punctuation. They look like tiny dots. They look like tiny dashes. They look like tiny squiggles. They look like somewhat longer squiggles. And a few of them are amorphous, that is, without any particular distinctive shape. So that's maybe five or six, if you include lengths of things, different morphologies for bacteria. That's not enough to go on if you're trying to sort out what may be millions of species of bacteria. I think you'd agree with me on that, that if we're trying to sort out millions of species of bacteria into their own separate categories, five or six different morphologies won't do it. We need to go with something else. In addition to those morphologies, by the way, some bacteria have particular types of motilities. Some of them have flagella, various numbers of flagella that are long, thin, thread, whip-like organelles extending from their cells that whip around and propel the bacteria through the water. The numbers of those flagella and the positions of those flagella also constitute a physical characteristic that we might latch on to. But again, that's deceptive, and it's certainly not useful by itself for categorizing millions of species of bacteria. What we turn to is to what bacteria do. Bacteria are all about what they do. By the way, I sometimes get a little frustrated when I get to a website on bacteria for the general public and see that it features a great many pictures of dots and dashes and not much of information about what the bacteria are doing, because I think that just helps along the misperception that we should be looking at them as tiny versions of ourselves. Not literally, but in a sense, that is looking for morphologies, looking for things that we can latch on to as though they were just another morphological entity on the family tree, when they're not. They're about what they do, and we really need to look at what they do. How do we do that? We look for things that they're putting out into the environment, signs of the little chemical reactions that are going on inside of them, and things that they are taking up from the environment. And it is surprisingly easy to see things that they are putting out and things that they are taking up. And that's what I will focus on when I talk in more detail about how to see bacteria in the environment. First of all, back to the family tree. Let me describe it a little bit further. And there is also a description that may help you in the book that goes with this course. Most of the family tree, and if you think of it as a big fan-shaped structure, an enormous open fan-shaped structure, the vast majority of that family tree consists of the bacteria and the archaea. And here I'm differentiating between the two of them, the bacteria and the archaea. And then a little branch of that fan, one rib of the fan, heading out, let's say, to the right, which is the way I usually draw it, heading out to the right, consists of the branch that will diversify into all the rest of the organisms, the protists, the fungi, the animals, and the plants. We're out there on the tip of one of those sub-branches. That's where we are on the giant family tree. Everything else is bacteria, and everything else is archaea. Well, for many, many years, microbiology labs had as their primary occupation categorizing and classifying bacteria and archaea, although at the time that they weren't necessarily known as archaea, but bacteria and archaea based on their activities on petri plates and their activities in respect to stains. So the entire list of identifiers consisted of what sugars these organisms would eat, what sorts of acids they might put out, what proteins these organisms would eat, what sorts of gases they might put out, what sorts of colors would they change if certain stains were added onto them. And it was all about the way they looked. And for a long time, that was the entire extent of the taxonomy and the sorting out and the classifying of all the bacteria and the archaea in the world. And it was very much laboratory bound. That is, you needed to bring the organisms in from wherever you collected them, and you then needed to get them going on petri dishes or in some other culture form, and you needed to get them to respond to things that you had in the laboratory. And a great deal was done with that, but it was limiting because we ended up with a large collection of organisms that could also be characterized by easy to use in the lab, or tractable in the lab, or cooperative in the lab, and not necessarily ones that were not easy to culture and that didn't respond readily to things that could be set up in a laboratory. It turns out to be an important limitation, and it turns out to be the limitation that characterized our understanding of bacteria and archaea through most of the 20th century until DNA sequencing became a routine thing. So what is DNA sequencing? I don't want to go another moment in this lecture without addressing that. It's a topic unto itself, of course. It's one of the most important innovations of the last part of the 20th century and into the 21st century in biology. It goes something like this, if I were to give a simplified account of what we do when we sequence. First thing we do is we get an organism that we would like to know the DNA of. And the DNA is the linear representation of all of the information that is needed to make that organism. The information is in the form of genes, and it's in the form of other sequences. And if you want to visualize it, it turns out that there are just four chemicals that make up DNA. It can be represented by the letters A, C, G, and T. So if I go looking at a DNA sequence loaded with information, I'm really looking at nothing but A's, C's, G's, and T's. Lines and lines and lines of them, all representing the information for a particular organism. I've got that organism. I take some of its DNA out. And here's the part that we can do now with a machine. So I'm not going to describe you what we used to you what we used to do in the old days by hand, which was laborious and which was tedious and which would take days and months to complete. I will simply walk us over to a machine called a sequencer. We will put the DNA into that sequencer, and it will use one or another of a couple of methods, which in essence go like this. And this is going to be a simplification of what these machines do. But in essence, they are removing one letter at a time, reading it, is an A, C, G, or T, recording that, removing the next letter, reading it, A, C, G, or T, removing the next one, and the next, and the next, and the next, and doing so in this amazing automatic and methodical way. There are errors that can be made. There are all kinds of little problems that can occur. But for the most part, it's an absolutely wonderful process. And out of that, you get a whole string of A's, C's, G's, and T's that represent the information that was in the DNA from the organism that you put in. Now, you're not quite done at that point. You've then got to analyze those A's, C's, G's, and T's. And that maybe is the most complicated process of it all, especially now that we have machines that can read DNA one letter at a time. And so the analysis of DNA is mostly a computational field. Computer programs are written that can look at strings of A's, C's, G's, and T's, looking for patterns, seeking out sections that look like they might be genes, and there are certain characteristics of sequences that are gene-like, other sequences that are not gene-like but are evocative of something else. And little by little, a computer program can analyze the strings that have been produced and to try to make a good guess at which sections are genes and which sections are something other than genes, which might also be interesting. And then all of this information gets put into databases. And as it happens, we have an enormous public database called NCBI, the National Center for Biotechnical Information. It is a free database. It is maintained by our government. It is the repository for all sequences that are funded by the government, which is a great many of them. And it's updated constantly. And you can go in and retrieve and analyze for yourself any sequence that you want for any organism that's databased there. And there's a huge database that consists entirely of bacterial and archaeal genomes, genomes being the complete set of DNA for those organisms. So it's all wonderful news. However, I will also say that the family tree of organisms is still very much bounded in laboratory methodologies that are not necessarily strictly sequencing methodologies. We're still working very much with much of what was developed for 20th century microbiology before sequencing became so routine. So that's one problem with the family tree, is that we're still developing our understanding of it, and still very much of it is based on laboratory-bound understandings of what bacteria and archaea can do. Second interesting confounding problem with understanding the family tree of bacteria is something called horizontal transfer, sometimes abbreviated HT. That's how common and prevalent it is. It actually requires its own little abbreviation for people who are writing it over and over again in their laboratory notebooks or field notebooks. So horizontal transfer. And it is very strange from our own point of view, and it is a real complexifying aspect of the family tree. Let me tell you or remind you what our own point of view is. We are obligately sexual organisms. We humans are obligately sexual, as are the other mammals. And by the way, there aren't all that many mammals, just a few thousand species. So we few thousand species of mammals absolutely require sex to pass on our DNA. And we don't really have any other way to do it. Of course, there are some interesting laboratory procedures, but I mean, as far as natural procedures, we don't have any other way of passing on our DNA to other generations. We don't have any way of me taking a little sliver off my finger and getting that started into another human being, for example. And we certainly don't have any method of transferring DNA in any kind of reliable way from one organism to another of a different species. Again, I'm talking about not any peculiar laboratory procedures. I just mean we don't have any natural way of passing DNA around in a promiscuous manner to completely different species. We're not exchanging DNA with dogs or with fungi or with plants. Guess what? The bacteria are, and they're doing it all the time, and it's called horizontal transfer. And so the way to think about this fan of this bacterial family tree with ourselves as just one little branch is that it's not just radiating arms or radiating branches of the tree, but that the tree is anastomosing, which is a word that is used when we refer to branches that come back together and fuse and then maybe branch out yet again. Anastomosing. It's an anastomosing family tree, particularly in the sections which are of the bacteria and the archaea, such that gene flow is going from one branch to another. It turns out bacteria and archaea are amazingly promiscuous with their DNA. Amazing to us. Amazing to us because we're limited in our sexuality. They are promiscuous in their DNA to the extent of picking up whatever DNA is in the environment, whether it's from other bacteria and archaea, or whether it's from animals or plants or protists or fungi, and incorporating it or not incorporating it, and transferring it in all different mechanisms. It's extremely useful that they do this so readily. It makes genetic engineering very easy, by the way. Genetic engineering is no invention by humans. It's merely harnessing what bacteria and archaea already do brilliantly. That is, transfer their DNA all in different directions at all times, such that what we've come to realize about the family tree is that at any given point, we're just getting a snapshot of where all the genetic information is. There is such a flow of genetic information from branch to branch. It's a sufficient snapshot that we can identify bacteria and archaea that we can consider to be species-like. But as far as looking for a really distinct species with solid boundaries such that DNA does not travel freely across those boundaries, such as what we think of for mammals, for example. As far as finding that kind of a picture of species for bacteria or archaea, it appears there is no such picture. It appears that there's much more of a flow of genetic information. So we have branches, but we have anastomosing branches, and we have a free flow of genetic information. So it means a number of things. It means that either we have, and we don't know which of these, by the way, either we have vastly overestimated the number of bacteria, or we have vastly underestimated a number of bacteria. And I suppose it could mean a third thing, too. It could mean that the word species doesn't really apply to bacteria in any kind of meaningful way. But let's say that species does, and we've either over or underestimated the number of species, and here's why. And here's why I think either of those possibilities are equally fascinating. Maybe we have overestimated the number of species of bacteria and archaea. Maybe the gene flow between the branches of the family tree is such that this snapshot of reality is so fleeting that what I call a species right now will not be a species in the sense of a species, you know, 100 years from now, 500 years from now. Maybe the flow is such that it's almost one big flowing gene pool, which is an interesting thought. Or maybe we have vastly underestimated the number of species or types of bacteria because we've been so limited to the laboratory during the last century, during the 20th century, when all the laboratory techniques for microbiology were being developed. And essentially, we were coming up with vast lists of bacteria who were tractable in the laboratory. I mean, that was a major criterion, something that we could actually get into the laboratory onto a petri dish and stain and get them to eat laboratory nutrients. Right now, microbiology is looking very much like a field for adventurers and explorers, people who want to get aboard ships and go out to the middle of the Pacific and go down on submersible research submarines and explore the deep seas and dig deep into the earth and go to the poles and go to the tops of mountains and go deep into caves. We're finding more and more and more different types, perhaps different species of bacteria. The more we look, the more we realize that we haven't been looking. And in DNA sequence analysis has made it possible. It means we don't need to bring these organisms back to the laboratory and force them to grow on petri dishes. Many of them will not. Or the ones that can grow are maybe not the most interesting of what we're collecting out there. But we can get their DNA sequences, and we can see just how strikingly different their capabilities must be because they've got a whole different set of genes coding for a whole different set of capabilities of things that they're doing. So maybe there are many, many more species or types to still be found, and that the new age of microbiology is not in the laboratory, but it's out on a boat, or it's on a polar ice cap, or it's deep inside of a cave taking samples for DNA analysis. So that's the picture of the family tree, and I find it delightfully complicated, and I like that there is some things that are not settled about it. It means we're in the middle of a very dynamic field at this point. It means there are a lot of exciting areas of research to get into in understanding the family tree. So I don't find it dismaying, although I have to admit that description may at first glance sound a little dismaying. In other words, there's nothing particularly solid right now that I can say except that bacteria and archaea cover most of the family tree, but in ways that we really don't have a complete understanding of. Here's something that I can say about the family tree with a fair amount of certainty, and that is one remarkable thing about the really baseline groups, the most ancient lineages of the bacteria and the most ancient lineages of the archaea, the ones that look like they're dating back as far back as we can go, close to 4 billion years ago. One thing I can say about those is they tend to live in extremely hot water. They're called hyperthermophiles. Some of them live at temperatures close to boiling. And that's an interesting, perhaps coincidence, perhaps not. And for those who don't consider it to be a coincidence, they consider it to be suggestive that life originated in extremely hot water, and that those ancient lineages of bacteria and archaea that are still hyperthermophiles and that we can still find on Earth are from those very early lineages. Now, there's other suggestive evidence for this. Right before 4 billion years ago, the Earth was molten. The Earth was still accreting, was still cooling down, and there was no liquid water on Earth, and therefore life as we know it, life as we understand it, probably could not have been evolving. We, of course, have to depend on what we understand life to be and our certain definitions of it. But previous to 4 billion years ago, it doesn't look like it would have been possible. Around 4 billion years ago, the Earth cooled enough that there was liquid water, but it was hot water. And a way to think about it is that it was geysers, it was hot springs. The Earth's crust was still relatively thin. There were probably volcanoes. There were probably rifts of the sort that we see in the Pacific vents right now, rifts where plates are pulling apart and extremely hot liquid and molten rock can come up. And this was the environment in which life originated perhaps 4 billion years ago. Thinking about that family tree that I suggested you either measure out across a room by pacing it off, or even if you're driving in your car that you think about as the extent of your dashboard across the front of your car, thinking about 4 billion years to the present, okay, with halfway across the timeline being about 2 billion years ago. Let me put some items on that timeline for you to visualize. We have the first microfossils, presumably of bacteria, at about 3.5 billion years ago. So on your timeline, we're just outside of that 4 billion year extent of your timeline. About 3.5 billion years ago are the first microfossils. What do they look like? They look like tiny dots and dashes, tiny punctuation points, featureless. You can't interpret much about them, although I will do a little bit of interpretation concerning those microfossils later in this lecture. But there's not much you can interpret from them. Typical of bacteria, okay, lacking morphology. In fact, it's amazing those microfossils were first found because it really took some faith to take a rock in which you could see nothing with your naked eye, cut it open, make a very, very thin section of it, and put it under a microscope and look for something as tiny as bacteria. It was an amazing thing to do. So if we have the first microfossils at about 3.5 billion years ago, and if the Earth was molten before 4 billion years ago, then we're extrapolating that the origin of life must have occurred somewhere around 4 billion years ago, because the fossils that we see at 3.5 are well enough developed, look like recognizable bacteria, such that they are, that can't be the origin of life. There must be something before that. And so that's why I have been saying in these lectures that we're placing origin of life at around 4 billion years ago, which is the extent of the timeline that I've been suggesting you try to visualize. Okay, now, other things that go on this timeline include the origin of more complicated cells, which is placed by some people at around 2.5 billion years ago. And I want to place them on this timeline right now because it turns out that those more complicated cells that make up us, that make up plants, that make up fungi and protists, the cells that actually have some morphology to them, the cells that really are the classic cells that people think of when they say describe a cell and describe the things that are inside of a cell, those complicated cells arose as combinations of bacterial cells in a way that ends up making us essentially communities of bacteria. We think we have our own complicated cells, but those complicated cells are really nothing more than bacterial cells that have gotten together. So it's an important point in the history of bacteria that around 2.5 billion years ago, some very interesting things began to happen with more complicated cells, but it's still part of the bacterial lineage. And it may be that those complicated cells were predisposed to being multicellular eventually, that they had characteristics that made it especially easy for them to get into multicellular, larger structures. Thus, we get fungi in animals and plants. But I still consider it to be part of the lineage of bacteria. And this leads me to some controversy about how to talk about these major lineages. And at this point, let me deviate a little bit into a controversy about how to classify bacteria and archaea and the organisms that came out of those complicated cells at 2.5 billion years ago. And for ordinary folks, including myself, I don't tend to want to get embroiled in this controversy, and yet I think it's unavoidable in some ways if we're going to have some sort of unified way of talking about it. And it goes something like this. Before we had a really rich understanding of who bacteria and archaea are and what exactly is going on with fungi and animals and plants and protists, and I'm assuming we have a rich understanding now. We probably don't still have as rich an understanding as people will have hundreds of years from now. But before we had our current understanding, all organisms were divided into two kingdoms, animals or plants. That left out bacteria and archaea. It left out fungi. It left out protists. And those all got jammed into one or another category. And they tended to get put into the category of plants. So just extra, extra tiny, cryptic, featureless plants were what bacteria were essentially considered. Obviously, that's not very satisfying. It's not very helpful. Two kingdoms was by no means a good way to divide everything up. Then came a 5 or 6 kingdom scheme. And for many, many years, that was the dominant scheme for dividing up organisms. And in fact, I have been using that throughout. And I will now deconstruct that scheme right now. You will hear that I've been using it throughout. I have been saying bacteria as one kingdom, and then I've been saying, usually in one sentence, the protists, which is a second kingdom, the fungi, which is a third kingdom, the plants, which are a fourth kingdom, and the animals, which are a fifth kingdom. Okay, and that's the traditional five-kingdom system, which took over from the two-kingdom system, and which is much more satisfying, and which put a spotlight on some organisms that up to that point had been just, a strange part of the plants, you know, something that we don't really need to give much more of a name to. They're just tiny, tiny versions of plants. Suddenly, into the textbooks, including textbooks at the elementary school level, middle school, and high school level, were fungi featured in their own kingdom, protists featured in their own kingdom, certainly bacteria in their own kingdom, along with animals and plants, each in their own kingdoms. Then came a slight modification of that called the 6-kingdom system, and that was with the acknowledgement that the bacteria could be divided into the archaea and the new group, the new subgroup bacteria that I've been talking about. Sixth kingdom, also satisfying, also acknowledges these diverse branches and also keeps in the forefront the real diversity of organisms that can be studied at either in schools or as naturalists. What has happened most recently is a three super kingdom system that takes into account the predominant members of the family tree of organisms, which are bacteria and archaea, and the relatively minor branch that extends off and consists of the animals and plants and protists and fungi. And some new thinking about this is that we ought to have three super kingdoms. One is the bacteria, one is the archaea, and the other is all the rest of those things. And that will reflect most accurately evolution. That will reflect most accurately what are the really major groups on the family tree. A great deal of scientific politics is involved with this. Scientific reputations are on the line concerning this issue. I know it's hard to believe. Sometimes I find it hard to believe, even though I'm in the field. It's actually enormously controversial. And sometimes I just like to step away from the whole thing and say, what will be served best, what will serve us best if we're trying to educate a new generation of biologists? Do I really want to take all of those fascinating groups, the protists and the fungi, along with plants that sometimes don't get enough attention in schools, and just kind of tuck them all together under one rubric? Not necessarily. I'm pointing all this out to you because if you decide to go searching for yourself about how to classify things on family trees and how to classify things on these timelines that I've been talking about, you will encounter aspects of this controversy. And it may seem a little confusing. And one thing that you should realize is this is another example of a field in flux, a field that has not settled down yet in respect to its taxonomy. There are some good aspects of that. It means there's still lots of work to be done. And taxonomy is one of those aspects of the work that needs to be done. But it does mean that if you're looking up these topics and trying to get a settled answer as to how to talk about the classification system and how to talk about the family tree, there will not necessarily be a simple answer to all of that. So I call it good news and bad news. Here's some good news. There was lots of speculation after the completion of the Human Genome Project as to what some of the consequences would be. Lots of really fun speculation, including the beginning of a new field of bioethics, considering what it would mean to know your entire genome and what it would mean to know what genes you had and what it would mean to know, you know, where particular traits, including disease traits, were coming from. Maybe even to be able to figure out, you know, what you would die of or what you had a high probability of dying from. So fascinating things to think about. But I think one of the most interesting and powerful consequences of the completion of the Human Genome Project was that suddenly, rather suddenly, all of those sequencers, those machines that were doing the sequencing, all those sequencers, all those tens of thousands of sequencers and the humans that operated them, tens of thousands of humans operating those sequencers, fell idle, temporarily idle, because it was done. The genome was done. And the analysis was just beginning. But as far as the cranking out of the actual sequence, it was done. Except that nothing's ever done. Nobody just closes the door on those sequencers and says, well, that was done. No, instead they turn to other things that they might sequence. And it turns out that it's very easy and quick to sequence a complete bacterium. It's actually fairly difficult to sequence something as complicated as a human. And that took a while, and those projects tend to take a while. But it's very easy to take a new bacterium that you just isolated from a cave or the deep sea or the poles or pretty much any place on Earth, bring it back to the laboratory, have it sequenced relatively cheaply, because the other great consequence of the Human Genome Project was the technology developed to the point where sequencing became cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, have it sequenced very, very quickly. And as a result, one of the really growing aspects of sequencing is the sequencing of bacterial and archaeal genomes. So if you go to the government database of sequences, which is NCBI, which is a public database where you can get any sequence of any organism you want, you certainly can find the human genome sequences, and there's more than one at this point. But you can find hundreds and hundreds of bacterial and archaeal sequences, and it's being that particular part of the database is being updated every single day, so that people who want to keep up with that need to look at it all the time. They need to monitor it constantly, and it's thanks to that that we have such a rich understanding now, and it's getting even richer by the day, of what the bacterial and archaeal parts of the family tree look like. So if I were to choose one really wonderful consequence of the Human Genome Project, besides a greater understanding of our own selves, it would be a much, much greater understanding, a very exciting understanding of bacteria and archaea. In the next lecture, I would like to elaborate more on those extreme bacteria that I alluded to that are called the hyperthermophiles, the ones that are growing at near boiling temperatures, and the ones that might be lineages dating back, probably not directly, but almost directly from a time that is around when we call the origin of life.
This ends Lecture 5.